Hello. If you are listening to Kate's wonderful podcast in America, you may be interested to know that Spectator now has a special US edition and website. My name is Freddie Gray. I edit that edition and website. And I'd like to tell you about a new subscription offer. If you go to spectator.us/free trial, you can get 3 full months digital access absolutely free. It's an amazing offer, and I'd encourage you all to take full advantage of it. That's spectator.us/free trial.
Hello and welcome to Coronomics, the Spectator's 6-part series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. This new podcast will feature our panel, based around the world, as each person selects a story that gives you an inside look as to what's happening outside their windows. Silvia Ciarilli Borelli is reporting from Rome and former Italian correspondent for Politico Europe. Jennifer Creary is reporting from Hong Kong and managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Nick Gillespie is reporting from New York City and editor-at-large for Reason magazine. Welcome all. Jennifer, some good news from Hong Kong on Monday. 0 new cases of infection from COVID-19 reported. But that hasn't stopped Hong Kong from planning. In fact, they have a 5-point plan, including one for what's being called catastrophe. Can you talk us through your story this week?
Yeah, so as you said, on Monday, Hong Kong recorded 0 new daily coronavirus cases. And this comes during a week of just single-digit daily coronavirus cases. But Hong Kong authorities are warning Hong Kongers not to drop their guard. Bearing in mind, Hong Kong didn't go into lockdown the same way that other European countries did. While, of course, you know, gyms are closed and other leisure and activity centres are closed, people are still out in the street, walking about, going to the beach, that kind of stuff, with various restrictions, including travel restrictions. But Hong Kong authorities are telling Hong Kongers to remain cautious and to continue to practice social distancing. For example, not gathering in groups more than 4 people. And I think that this is a good precautionary measure, particularly because if we look at other Asian countries, such as, you know, Singapore, which was previously lauded for its response to the coronavirus, but has now seen a massive surge in a number of cases. We can really look at countries like that as a cautionary tale, not to drop our guard and to continue to practice social distancing and other measures.
Because this article that you flagged from the South China Morning Post doesn't actually read like it's particularly great news. It leads with the fact that things could get worse very quickly and Hong Kong has to be prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is because of what Hong Kong went through during the SARS epidemic in 2003. Because Hong Kong was so badly hit by SARS, just because of the nature of how Hong Kong is structured, the residential buildings are very tightly compact. Actually, the way that SARS initially spread in Hong Kong was a single doctor came over to Hong Kong and was unwell, and his apartment block ended up, many people inside ended up getting infected. Over 300 people got infected. So because of the way that Hong Kong is structured, it's very susceptible to these kinds of diseases. So I think Hong Kong authorities are very cognizant of that, and as a result, they've told people to remain cautious.
So could you talk a bit about how, you know, the protections against spreading the coronavirus are intersecting with the political protests? And, you know, when we hear stories about Hong Kong authorities saying this or that, are those local authorities who have more confidence and trust of residents of Hong Kong, or are those representatives of Beijing? And, you know, what is the sense of people in terms of the advice they're getting not to congregate in groups that might ultimately give rise to protest or, you know, kind of larger anti-Beijing sentiment?
Yeah, absolutely. So this week has been particularly eventful for that. As you mentioned, Hong Kong last year went through months of protest against not only local authorities, but also authorities in Beijing. And so there's certainly a fear among local Hong Kongers that the government can use the coronavirus as a pretext to further crack down on civil liberties in Hong Kong. And one of the ways that we're seeing this is the use of these various anti-epidemic measures, such as the limiting number of people who can gather to 4 people, and essentially allowing local law enforcement to enforce these measures. But of course, as we've spoken about before, there have been accusations that they're targeting protesters or people who are outwardly displaying kind of pro-democracy, pro-protester signs. So there is certainly that fear, and that all comes down to just a lack of trust in Hong Kong authorities and Chinese authorities. But I think a very important point that needs to be made is that because Hong Kong has registered so few coronavirus cases this week, it's really emboldened Hong Kong and mainland Chinese authorities to take risky political action that would otherwise attract scrutiny from the international community, because of course the eyes of the world are focused on the pandemic in various different countries. And so kind of two of these examples have been two of Beijing's representative offices in Hong Kong have issued very strongly worded statements criticizing the inner workings of Hong Kong's legislature. So that could pose a constitutional problem in terms of Hong Kong's political autonomy. And the second one, which is really quite unprecedented, was the arrest of 15 pro-democracy figures on Saturday, ostensibly over their involvement in last year's protests. So there is a sense that by enabling these simmering, you know, simmering political tensions to kind of rise to the fore, this can really hobble the government's ability to tackle what could very well be a second wave of infections. And this is particularly dangerous if there is a resumption of, for example, large-scale protests, like you just mentioned, like the ones that we saw last year. And that could be particularly dangerous if you're trying to tackle a pandemic, right? But I mean, Hong Kongers are pragmatic. They're not going to go out if there's a real possibility of infection. But there is certainly a fear that when you have these two crises, the pandemic and the ongoing political crisis, that this can be particularly detrimental for how local authorities, the government and health authorities are able to tackle the coronavirus in Hong Kong.
Jennifer, speaking of civil liberties, a lot of attention is being paid to the methods that are being used in places like Hong Kong around testing and tracing. Talk already in the West about, you know, some kind of app that would basically breach a lot of aspects of civil liberty that we've become very accustomed to in the West, but that might help us get out of our home sooner and end the lockdown sooner. I would love to know what Sylvia and Nick think about what might be politically feasible and accepted in places like Italy and the UK. But are there lessons to be learned from what Hong Kong has done so far in terms of tracing people and the civil liberties aspect of that?
There has been some concern over the use of digital technology to trace residents. So, for example, the most notable one being is that anyone who arrives in Hong Kong has to wear these electronic bracelets that essentially track your movements and make sure that you don't actually leave your house, the place where you're supposed to be isolated for 14 days, which is the period where between contracting the virus and displaying symptoms. And so because that device, you basically have to download an app in order to connect to this bracelet, there is a concern that the use of this kind of digital surveillance technology could be used to curb civil liberties. And I think, at least in Hong Kong, people are particularly cognizant of that. And as a result, people are very cautious. But certainly in terms of how the international community has viewed Hong Kong, I think there is a sense that Hong Kong has done pretty well in terms of being able to trace the number of people, hence why we've had zero new cases today. And actually, most of the new infection cases that have come over the past week have been people traveling from abroad. Hong Kongers coming back from places like the UK, the US, where they're studying, coming back into Hong Kong. But in that respect, Hong Kong has done quite well in terms of actually tracing people who have been coming into the city.
Sylvia, what do you make of it?
Well, here in Italy, it's completely different. And the European Union has said that for European countries, these apps can only be voluntary. So it cannot be a situation where citizens must mandatorily download these tracing apps. In Italy, the situation, I think, is quite mixed. The public is very much keen to share this type of information, and the government forecasts 70% of citizens to actually be willing to download these voluntary apps. But at the same time, I think Italy isn't a very digital country. It's not very tech savvy. So I think it will be very complicated for the government. For example, up until now, all the people who were tested weren't actually kept under control by health health authorities. I was struck by what Jennifer was saying about the electronic bracelets. I mean, the people that have been in auto-isolation or quarantining at home in Italy have just been left on their own, and it's been up to their own responsibility and to their own behavior to make sure they stayed at home. And as far as their contacts, for the people that were actually positive to the test, it's not very clear as to whether their contacts have been contacted and whether they are being traced and kept under control by health authorities. So definitely there is a general sense that in order for the economy to reopen, it's very important for these apps to work and for this tracing to happen. But I think we're very, very far from that moment right now.
That's interesting. In the UK, they're not giving much away in terms of what the exit strategy would be. We just started getting some briefings over the weekend about phasing certain things back in over the summer. But I think there are major questions as to whether or not the public, how comfortable the public would actually be, not just in having their location traced, but also having so much of their health data on an app that's so easily accessible. So we'll be following that closely. Probably something to come up in our coming discussions over the weeks. But for now, Sylvia, let's turn to Italy, one of the hardest hit places in Europe when it comes to COVID-19, a death toll over 20,000 at the moment. However, it's taking its first steps to return to some kind of normality this week. Tell us about it.
Yes, that's correct. So the Italian government decided that children's stores and bookstores could reopen starting from April 14th. So for some weird reason, because it's not actually clear to many people why they chose children's stores and bookstores, these shops were allowed to reopen. But the story I chose actually describes how even the major bookstore chains have been very cautious in reopening. And in certain cities like Milan and the capital, Rome, the local authorities have actually required them to wait or to move this reopening schedule down the line. Because in fact, the question here, which is quite well described in the story, is how are these businesses planning to reopen and how will customers' behaviors change? And of course, considering the whole country is still in lockdown and there are restrictions on movements and offices and factories are shut, maybe the reason for which these type of stores were allowed to reopen is because they would attract less people, and it's not the typical type of business that attracts thousands of people in at once. Also, culture and reading has been a big part of how people have entertained themselves during these 2 months in lockdown. On social media, people were posting pictures of the books they were reading, and you know, they were giving reading tips to friends. And children have been a big problem for families, because entertaining children and figuring out what to make children do all throughout the day for what is now coming up to 8 weeks since schools have closed has been a big issue. So obviously reopening these stores where you can go buy colors or toys for them or even clothes. For example, I have problems with my own daughter's clothes because all her leggings now have holes in them. So it was actually pretty useful for me for these stores to reopen. But obviously these aren't the types of stores that will cause, you know, hundreds of people coming together or traveling on public transportation at any one given time together to go to those stores. So the question more broadly here now is, how will these restrictive measures be lifted without risking a new surge in cases? And this is something that regional governors have been pushing because the impact on the economy is going to be very severe. The IMF has forecasted a drop in GDP in Italy that is close to 10% for 2020. And every extra day of closure has a bigger impact on the economy. But the question is, how do you avoid people cramming on public transportation? How do you avoid risks for school children when they go into classrooms? The education minister has said that children will return to school in September. So another question is, how do you reopen offices and factories if these workers have children at home who aren't cared for? So lots of complicated questions that remain unanswered, but we should have a bit more clarity going into May, because it looks like these restrictive measures will lift on May 3rd. And so as of May 4th, a number of businesses should start reopening, and we should have more clarity in the days to come.
I'll jump in with some contrast to do with Hong Kong, because many students have remained at home. Similarly, you know, it's driving their parents mad. But Hong Kong has the additional problem of having these incredibly tiny living spaces and a huge wealth gap. And so one of the main debates over the past week has been the resumption of what's called the DSE exam. So that's the exam for high schoolers. It's a very important one at the end of school. And basically, the government has introduced a date for these exams. But actually, there's been huge backlash from student groups. Hong Kong has many student groups, and many of the students are saying actually they don't feel safe to sit these exams and to continue learning because they do not believe that the government is able to ensure their safety when it comes to protecting them against the virus. For example, they have accused the government of using old masks, dirty masks, not sitting them far enough from each other in exam halls. So there's been that element in Hong Kong.
Is there actually evidence that they're using dirty masks, or is this just a fear coming from the lack of trust in the region?
Yeah, so these are coming from student groups.
Right.
And so these are testimonies, and the student groups have held press conferences about that, saying that students have said that they have been using dirty masks or been provided with dirty masks. So we're going off what the students are saying.
Nick?
This raises a ton of questions about the reopening of stuff. And in the United States, I think one of the things that people are starting to grapple with is, okay, you open stuff up, but will people come anyway? Because there's a lot of surveys and polling that shows, 60, 70, 80% of people don't want to go to a theater, don't want to go to a restaurant, We've been in this position where they killed the economy, both at the federal level, but especially at state levels, for about a month now. Supposedly, over the past month or so, there's been a 30% contraction of the economy. Los Angeles County was saying that they had something like 47% unemployment. And when the lockdown ends, it doesn't mean everything will go back to normal. So it's really interesting to see how other countries are doing this. And, I know that Sweden, which has been pursuing a kind of unorthodox strategy or a heterodox strategy of not shutting things down, they've also seen a major decline in economic activity. But that might be a place as, the pandemic crests and starts to recede, to see how they handle a resumption of normality. But right now, in the United States, I think what is terrifying people is the slow recognition that, when this is kind of over, it doesn't mean the economy is going to actually come roaring back in any meaningful way.
Well, that's a great point, Nick, because Sylvia, in the article that you flagged from Quartz, it's got this amazing quote in it that says about the bookshops opening, customers will not be as free to roam between shelves or to browse books as before. I mean, that's not a bookshop. Right. As far as anybody's concerned, that is not business as usual. So even though these stores are opening, and as you said before, they're not necessarily the most obvious ones that people would pour into overnight, it really isn't going to be like it was before.
Absolutely not. And also, think about the summer season coming up, during which Italy normally attracts millions of tourists. There are now plans to perhaps put up plexiglass boxes on beaches for people to be divided and to ensure social distancing. And there are questions as to whether people can actually go into the water and swim. So obviously, you are reopening and you are telling people that they can go to the beach, but will people go to the beach if they need to be distanced and sit under the heat in a plastic box and they're not allowed to swim? So of course, there will be ways in which these restrictions will be lifted. And I'm sure they are looking at ways that are going to improve the situation from what it currently looks like. But the minute you impose face masks and social distancing and these plexiglass walls in restaurants to divide tables or on beaches, it's obviously not something you can call normal, right?
It's not really Italian ambiance, is it?
I know some people in higher education who do work with study abroad programs, and in the United States, Italy is one of the most popular, if not the most popular, probably outside of the UK, destination for study abroad. And basically, everybody is just conceding that there will be no travel, particularly to Italy, in the fall because, you know, the bad look of, you know, just so many people getting sick, particularly in northern Italy, which tends to be the places that the study abroad programs are located. You know, it's going to be a long slog getting back to, you know, just normal volume, much less what you guys were talking about of like, nobody's going to go to the beach, right? If you're sitting under a magnifying glass and can't go in the water.
No, it's definitely not as attractive as it was before. Let's move from Europe to the US. And Nick, your story this week is about predictions that haven't exactly come true. So talk us through it.
Yeah, so I chose a piece by Kyle Smith, who writes for National Review, which is a conservative publication. Among other things, what he was talking about is in New York State, and particularly New York City and the greater New York area, including places like Westchester County, just north of the city, and Long Island, is the epicenter in the United States, you know, and I guess by extension, in many ways, the world of coronavirus. And the governor here, who was first, you know, heavily criticized for being slow off the ball and talking well into March about how, you know, this was not a big deal and, you know, we don't need to change our habits yet, to now he's being lauded for kind of being empathetic with people suffering. He's doing a version of Donald Trump's daily press conferences. And essentially the messages from both are the same. You know, we're going to get through this, but Andrew Cuomo, who has a very negative and harsh public persona, has been empathetic and talking about feeling, you know, people's pain. So he's gotten better marks. But Kyle Smith in National Review talked about how at various points Cuomo had been saying just a couple of weeks ago that New York needed as many as 40,000 ventilators to deal with the crush of patients and that they only had 12,000 ventilators. The pandemic seems to have peaked here, both in New York City and New York State. And it's also fascinating if you separate out upstate New York, it essentially has virtually zero cases. It's all really centered in New York City. But they never came close to hitting, you know, getting beyond the ventilators that they had. And in fact, New York State is now giving ventilators or lending them to nearby states and hospitals and things like that. And it raises a question that is going to become a real, I think, both epidemiological, but also political and kind of cultural football over the next couple of weeks. And it's definitely going to influence how and when and why things get reopened or not. But all of the predictions in the United States, even with keeping social distancing, you know, as a presumption of mortality rates or fatality rates and infection rates, just have not come to pass. And so, you know, you have a governor who was saying we need 40,000 ventilators and then not even coming, you know, anywhere close to that. I mean, less than a third of that was what was ultimately needed. And people in the United States, you know, they simultaneously tend to be very obedient. I mean, like, you know, most people are following social distancing and they're doing it, you know, somewhat happily, if grudgingly, but they also resist being told what to do. And you're starting to see flare-ups against the lockdown on the grounds that it was ill-conceived or it was oversold. And I think this type of story points to a reality that the numbers in the United States have been wildly inflated from the beginning. And as that starts to sink in, people are going to start to push back against anything coming from kind of official sources. And that might lead to an early wonderful liberation from overwrought tactics, or it might lead to a second wave.
I just wanted to say that this really echoes what has been happening in Italy. We've seen these COVID hospitals being built throughout the country, including in regions that haven't seen a very severe outbreak at all. And these regional governors that have said they needed hundreds and hundreds of ventilators and critical medicine beds, but actually facts have told a completely different story. And whether these numbers and these figures that were all over the place at one point will be accurate and will prove accurate further down the line is still to be seen. But for now, it seems like it was a bit of a political issue, especially between the governors that didn't belong to the same party of the prime minister and the national government. So it feels like politics is really mixing into a health emergency, and the lines are a bit blurred between facts and political opinion. And I think it could be very risky if it continues this way.
Yeah, if I can just follow up on that, in the wake of 9/11, which is probably the closest analog to this in terms of a national, like an event that caused a national mobilization in the United States, you got a lot of weird requests where people in places like Columbus, Ohio, or Nebraska demanding that they get a certain amount of money that was now being thrown at national security. And it became a political issue where you couldn't, if you were in Washington in the federal government, you couldn't say, look, nobody is going to blow up Columbus, Ohio, or you know, a farm town in Nebraska. You couldn't say that. And so you ended up giving out a lot of money that was designed to protect, you know, specific targets or high-risk targets for terrorism. It ends up going to places that don't really need that. And I think you're seeing something like that in the United States where, you know, you can't, in this kind of moment, it's a weird thing. You can't say no to claims that really don't make a lot of sense.
Well, this is the trade-off, isn't it? Because if you go against the science and, you know, implicitly it seems like a good idea to treat it as fact when you don't have the benefit of hindsight, then you're taking on a huge risk. When Trump said that the U.S. didn't need as many ventilators as it did, was he right or was he just lucky? I mean, it's so difficult to know. These are really fast decisions that have to be made.
And, you know, and I've been trying to figure this out, and I don't have the statistical background to do it, and I haven't found people who have done it yet. But when you look at the places where there were outbreaks and the timing of lockdown orders, there does not seem to be a very tight correlation. And so you have a state like California, which locked down early and has been, you know, has done a good job in terms of, like, it hasn't had many cases. So, you know, that seems to be good. Then you have a place like New York, which was kind of late and had most of the cases. But then you have a state like Florida, where the governor has been roasted for not closing things down earlier because he wanted to keep beaches and tourist destinations open for spring break. They actually have a relatively, you know, a mild case when you look per capita. It's a massive population state in the U.S., and it's actually been doing extremely well. And then there's like a bunch of states that have literally no deaths and virtually no cases that are now, people are saying, oh, you know, the case rate is growing phenomenally there because it goes from, you know, 7 new infections a day to 8 or 9 or 10. It's very hard to, I mean, I don't even think we can agree on the facts yet and then go from that to, like, you know, what's politics or not. But it seems like a lot of luck has been involved in things in the United States.
Yeah, if I may add to that, just talking about politics intermingling with public health issues. In Hong Kong, this was early on in the outbreak, we saw a lot of kind of xenophobia against mainland Chinese people in Hong Kong. There's a large percentage of the population are from mainland China, but there was already some anger against mainland Chinese people prior to the outbreak because of the protests. But particularly at the beginning, we saw, for example, restaurants and businesses refusing business to Mandarin-speaking customers, Mandarin being the language in mainland China, Cantonese in Hong Kong. And we saw that as well in the protests. And we really saw some ugly xenophobia. And actually, when the government did enact tighter travel restrictions, it was only after medics went on strike, they basically unionized and urged the government to enact a full border closure, although they didn't. Still, they closed many of the cross-border checkpoints. But having said that, Hong Kong, as a city that is right next to China, it's right near the epicenter of the outbreak, it's managed to keep a relatively low number of cases. I think today it's just over 1,000 people have been recorded to have been infected, with only 4 deaths. So, you know, as Nick was saying, there's no kind of this, it's very difficult to measure why that's the case, but certainly it's something, it's to do with how the population has reacted and how the government has reacted as well.
This is really interesting because the story that I want to bring to the table from the UK this week, I think, bridges the politics of COVID-19 with Nick's story about resources. So the Times is flagging this week essentially a one-woman protest. A 27-year-old doctor who is 6 months pregnant with her first kid has taken to standing outside of Downing Street, that's the Prime Minister's residence, with a sign that says, "Protect healthcare workers." And what she's flagging has been the big concern in the UK about a lack of PPE, personal protective equipment. And we've been talking for weeks about sourcing ventilators, and it turns out that not as many have been needed as we previously thought. In fact, some doctors have decided not to use them for certain patients because they think it can have an adverse effect. But there have been major concerns about PPE. This past weekend, thankfully it didn't happen, but there were thoughts that we might not actually have enough to get through the weekend. So I think the story obviously flags that, but it also flags that people are quite quickly starting to point fingers and make this a political issue. I was kind of under the assumption that for a while longer, we would be in a we're all in this together mentality where politicians across the spectrum, people who vote different ways, would be united in simply tackling the virus. But not only are we still reporting on the virus in real time, a lot of different groups are starting to look backwards retrospectively, even by just a few weeks, asking questions about how the government has handled COVID-19 and whether or not it made the right decisions. And I'd be interested to know if that's happening elsewhere. Are things becoming more politicized?
It is. Here in Italy, it's become very, very political. And we have a very similar situation with PPEs. I've reported and I've been following stories of small local hospitals throughout the country that have scrambled to set up intensive care units from scratch, and that have now ended up with 20 or even more ventilators, but at the same time, they don't have the healthcare workers to actually operate those units. And at the same time, the nurses and the doctors they do have don't have enough face masks and personal protective equipment, and they are getting infected. And why this happened isn't very clear. The Italian government is saying it's because all of these devices were produced in China, because Europe at one point a few years ago started producing PPEs because they were cheap and they weren't very technological. So they just left the production to China. And at one point, China stopped shipping them to us. Other people are saying it's because the Italian government made lots of mistakes and because the bureaucracy complicated things very much. I know for a fact that people that have organized donations, whether on GoFundMe or other platforms, were actually able to source these personal protective equipments from China faster than government agencies and actually deliver them to these local hospitals themselves. So lots of question marks there. And I think one of the issues the Italian public is very much focusing on is why the government is spending so much public money on all these expensive devices and medical equipment before taking care of the basics. Because, of course, if you have doctors and nurses getting infected, even if you have great equipment, you don't have anyone to operate them.
Yeah, I think something very similar is going on in the United States. And I talked to a doctor who teaches at Harvard and then works at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and is pulling shifts now. And he said that they don't have shortages, but they're rationing stuff, like they're thinking about it, which is quite different. And in New York City, there have been, you know, reports of people being out of masks in particular and gloves and things like that, although that seems to the supplies have started building up again. And I know just walking around Manhattan yesterday, every street corner, and this is a change really of just a week ago, people were selling masks, you know, that you could walk around on the streets with, which is new. So, you know, the market seemed to have come back to that. There's a related story to what you were talking about, Kate, too, which I've read, and there's an English or UK version and a US version of either the National Health Service or private hospital chains, you know, and the corporations, the healthcare companies that run stuff, of trying to silence dissent or worker, you know, doctors and people working within their systems from saying, you know, we're kind of screwed up here. This isn't working very well. And that's a kind of related issue, which is also, you know, is starting to get more and more press in the United States of what is going on with workers, especially in healthcare industries, but in other businesses too that have been working overtime. So Amazon workers, what is their right of expression? Are they actually telling the truth? Or, you know, in the United States, there's always, whenever something like this happens, unions tend to flex a little bit and talk about why, you know, whatever is going on perfectly illustrates why all their demands should have been met 10 or 15 years ago. Employers will have a different version of that story. But that's adding to the general anger, conflict, and also lack of clarity, to be quite honest, because, again, we don't really have good clear, believable information about, you know, what are the basic facts here?
If I may jump in when it comes to statistics. So on Friday, Wuhan authorities, Wuhan is the city in China where the virus was first detected, they increased the number of recorded fatalities by over 50%. They announced this through state media. And the doctor that the medical professionals that Nick was just referring to in China referred to the ones early on in the outbreak in Hubei province, particularly Dr. Li Wenliang, who sent a message to his colleagues, basically flagging up this new kind of pneumonia, and he was subsequently reprimanded for it by Chinese authorities. And so I think that's intimately connected to why Wuhan authorities decided to declare this increase in the number of fatalities as well as infections, but the fatalities was the largest jump. And I think that is because there was a lot of domestic backlash over unrecorded deaths and unrecorded infections, particularly among family members in Wuhan and Hubei province. And certainly Chinese authorities are very aware of that, and they're aware of the public anger. And there's a lot of anxiety and distrust when it comes to China and the numbers coming out of China, particularly when you look at the SARS epidemic back in 2003. And there was kind of infamously a cover-up at the beginning, and there have been accusations that Chinese authorities have attempted to cover up this current coronavirus. And so we're seeing a lot of distrust of numbers, and it's very difficult to compare the numbers in China to anything else, because of course there aren't any other statistics other than the official ones given by China. So there's a lot of uncertainty in that respect.
That's been flagged up a lot in the UK about these international comparisons, particularly with China, given the lack of trust in those figures, but also just how every country is calculating slightly differently. I do find it remarkable the extent to which public opinion is swaying health policy. I think it was felt here with the school closures about when those happened. There's definitely public support in the UK still for the lockdown, which means that very little has been given away as to any kind of exit strategy. But the combination of health and science and public policy and politics is coming to a head so quickly. It already feels very politicized here. It sounds like it does elsewhere.
Yeah, I can tell you. I mean, you know, we're in the middle, it doesn't feel like it, but we're in the middle of a presidential election year, so the stakes are particularly high. And already that is starting to reemerge after, Kate, you were talking about a kind of moment of bonhomie of, you know, where people are like, we're all in this together. That is, you know, that's shedding extremely quickly in the United States. And I think over the next couple of weeks, in particular, because the numbers are going down everywhere, the peak seems, or at least one hopes it's the only peak, but certainly the first peak seems to have been reached. You know, that's going to come back. And going into this, I mean, I've written a lot about over the past 50 years how trust and confidence in major institutions, but especially political and governmental institutions in the United States, is at historic lows. This isn't going to help any of that. And what comes next is going to be, you know, pretty disturbing, I think. Generally speaking, there's a broad consensus among sociologists and economists that when people stop believing in government, when they start to believe they're in a low trust society, in a corrupt society, oddly, they ask the government to do more and more to kind of regulate things and to make things fair. So you, and then they fail at that and you get this, you know, kind of downward spiral. And I think this is going to accelerate it greatly in the United States.
Support for politicians in the UK has actually been on the rise, but things are moving so quickly, who knows where we'll be in a week's time. I do know, however, that Coronomics will be back next Tuesday for our new episode. Thanks so much to Nick, Sylvia, and Jennifer for joining me. You'll be back next week as well. And to all of our listeners, please subscribe to Spectator Radio. And if you're listening in the US, you can subscribe for a discount, spectator.us/subscribe, to get our digital and print content. The promo code is Kate.